Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
At The Intercooler, we're proud to have JBR Capital on board as a podcast sponsor. They're a great fit for us because, like The Intercooler, they're geared up around the car enthusiast. JBR Capital is the UK's only independent finance lender dedicated solely to high-end vehicle finance. That's all the company does. It means JBR Capital knows the car marketplace inside out and therefore is properly geared up to tailor finance quotes around the individual. There's no one-size-fits-all approach with JBR. In 2022, the company expects to surpass £1 billion of lending in only its eighth year. The company can finance new cars, classic cars, sports cars, supercars, hypercars, any car, in fact, with a value greater than £25,000. The company's motto is fund your passion. And let's face it, without car finance, how many of us would really be able to afford to fund our passion for cars? So get in touch with JBR Capital before buying your next car. You'll find contact information in the description. And as ever, tell them The Intercooler sent you. Right, let's get on with this week's podcast.
Welcome to The Intercooler Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 104 of the podcast. I'm Dan Prosser with Andrew Frankel, as always. Good morning, Andrew.
Morning, Dan.
So we're talking this week about all the lost British car makers, with a particular focus on the ones that have been revived successfully or otherwise. There's so many of them. But before we get stuck in, there's one thing I want to mention, which is our mate, our TI contributor, David Tuig, who's the brilliant engineer who now writes for us. He's got a book out. It's called Inside the Machine, An Engineer's Tale of the Modern Automotive Industry. And I mention it now because, well, the book came out last week, and as far as I can tell, it seems to be doing really well on Amazon. And we're going to be running an extract from the book on the app very soon. So if you're a TI subscriber, keep an eye out for that. I mean, it's worth mentioning because David writes so well for us, doesn't he, about the industry, about the job of being a car engineer. He writes in an entertaining but informative way. And I've had a leaf through the book. I've not read the whole thing. I've read good chunks, mostly about the Alpine. It's the same stuff, same insightful, interesting stuff that you didn't know before. So, keep an eye out for the extract.
I haven't had a leaf through it because it's so popular at the moment. Amazon can't even tell me what time when mine's going to arrive. So I think the thing about it is, you know, David, he's such an instinctive and excellent writer that, you know, frankly, he could be writing about budgerigars. And it's just writing that is great to read, almost whatever he's writing about. And he also happens to be writing about stuff that, you know, we find really interesting. So hopefully you guys will too.
Yeah, Inside the Machine, it's called. All right, let's crack on then. Before we sort of start talking about specific car makers, I just want to wonder why there have been so many British car companies that have come and gone over the years. And I think there are an infinite number of reasons. One is that it's a sheer numbers game, isn't it? That Britain has long been a hotbed of engineering and manufacturing, maybe not so much manufacturing recently, but it was at one point. And so there were just so many small independent car companies that sprouted up out of the ground, weren't there? And they couldn't all survive.
No, they couldn't all survive, but you'd have thought more than have done. I mean, so I was just sort of knocking about on Wikipedia, and they've got a page called, it's called something like Defunct British Car Marks. So these are car companies which, you know, have absolutely, I don't know how many British car marks exist today as such. I mean, not many. But this list of defunct cars, it is 422 different car companies.
Wow.
Even gone. So actually, so yeah, so if you, yeah, defunct, gone. So if you're sitting here thinking, I really like to start up a car company, just think about your odds first. I mean, statistically, that's why I find guys like Ariel, Simon Saunders, who started that up out of nothing, and actually made a go of it and made it succeed, and now has a thriving business. I've just lost an admiration for those guys, because the chances of actually establishing something, particularly today with all the, you know, the hoops you have to jump through, all the legislative stuff, and actually get a business. And also, people are all, we're all, you know, well, not all of us, but a lot of people are just bad snobs. And, you know, you could build the best car in the world, and, you know, people still wouldn't buy it because it would call a Frankel or a Prusser, when they'd much rather, you know, drive a Porsche, because that's easy to explain to your mates. And so it's such a hard thing to do. And, yeah, as we know, you know, the vast, 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 vast majority come and they go. Sad, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there are many more reasons as well, particularly on the sort of the mass market side, politics, trade unions, short-sighted management, cost-cutting, competition from Europe and Far East especially. There are just so many reasons, but I think at the heart of it, and you've touched on it there, it's that the car-making game is fearsomely difficult. It's so hard to do. And I'm just sort of reminded of Aston Martin, Lotus, Jaguar. They are among the best established car marks in the world. They have long traditions building beautiful and groundbreaking cars. Their brands are incredibly strong, desirable. Yep. And the terrible times
they
struggle. Those companies. So endlessly, how many times has Aston gone bust?
I don't know. It's well into double figures. I can't remember who it was, but I was having a conversation with someone. I was in America. And I was talking to somebody about exactly this, and they were saying, why would you start a car company, something which is requires so much upfront investment, which is so likely to fail, when actually, what are you going to get at the end of it? I mean, the margins. I mean, if you're a Louis Vuitton and you're selling handbags, your margins on those are, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of percents. In cars, it's like single digits. So you're doing all this, and what for? And those margins are so easily eroded and so subject to the fickle finger of fate and fashion and everything else. It's such an enormous punt for such little potential return at such potentially catastrophic cost. I just admire anyone who has a go. I wouldn't think about it.
I'm reminded of a story our old mate David Tuig told. He did write about it, actually. It was a conference for the Renault-Nissan alliance. And there was a lot of speculation at the time, and I think within the automotive industry, concern that Apple was looking at building a car and getting into the car market. And someone put this question to Carlos Ghosn, who said on stage, why would Apple get into a terrible business like ours? They make margins of 50%, mostly on software. We make margins of a few percent on fearsomely complicated machines that are very difficult to build, to distribute, and then have to be serviced and warrantied and all sorts. And he just said, they wouldn't bother. They wouldn't get into this sector because it's so terrible. Which is, yeah, interesting coming from a guy like him, isn't it? So, it's hard to know where to start really with this, but at the top of my list, I've got Jensen. So, that seems like as good a place to start as any. Also, a good time to do it because Jensen was founded actually as W.J. Smith & Sons Limited in West Bromwich 100 years ago this year.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there you go. So it's a very, very old mark, or at least W.J. Smith & Sons is a very old mark, and it's much later on that it became Jensen. So, I mean, they, yeah, brothers Alan and Richard Jensen gave the company that name. And over the years, it's built some significant and interesting cars. The Interceptor, the FF, first all-wheel drive car with, and first car with ABS as well, I think.
It was. Groundbreaking.
It's extraordinary. Extraordinary that a tiny little mark could do that.
And also, they were one of those car brands. Allard is another, actually, which, and I guess you could say AC did it as well, which managed to marry quite successfully British car design with American mechanical, you know, Detroit, Bent 8, V8, iron. And they were good. I mean, Jensen's came with big, I think they were like 6.3-litre Chrysler V8 motors. Big, lazy lump of a car in a machine which looks really quite cool. I can remember there was, when I was at school, there was some girl who I was quite taken with, and her dad drove an Interceptor.
I wonder why you were taken with her.
Well, possibly. yes, don't know. But I mean, but I can just remember this white thing sort of growling around the corner as he came to sort of pick her up, and just thinking that is just so. I've never driven one. I'm not sure they're that great to drive. Someone's making them again now, aren't they? With like LS3s or Corvette engines in them.
Yeah,
I think. But you know, so my connection to Jensen is that they were revived. The brand came back at the end of the 1990s, and produced this thing called the SV8, which is quite a curious car. But at the time, and I can remember it very vividly because I was, you know, right at the cutting edge, we took it very seriously. They seemed to have some money about them. The car looked credible. And they actually, unlike so many of these car companies which kind of like put a car on a show stand and never seen again, it got into production. They actually made some. They sold some. I think they made 40 cars, but I'm not sure they actually sold 40 cars. I think they sold like half of those, and then the rest were, you know, in various states of disassembly. And then I think the thing is, and the reason it is so bloody difficult is car manufacturers, people who want to start up a new car manufacturer, they have a great idea. Because they know exactly what they want to build. They build an amazing prototype. Because it's new, because the press is always hungry for column inches, it gets lots of noise. It goes on a show stand. Maybe they get it to run. Maybe they do some early drives or whatever. And we go, woo! And what they don't appreciate, what they appear not to appreciate, is they basically haven't begun the job. Because the job is not to design an amazing car. The job... is to put a car into production at a price which A, the customer will pay, and B, which will return you sufficient profit to be able to continue to keep it in production, and at a quality that is going to ensure that these customers don't just buy one, when they're done with that, they go and buy another. And compared to that, actually designing a car and getting getting one car built, walk in the park, dead easy, doddle. And it's always the turning that great idea into a hard-nosed, profitable production reality, which is so, so difficult.
Crikey. When you frame it like that, you just think, why would anyone bother? It's just too difficult.
Why would they bother? Just go and buy something else which somebody else has done. Somebody else had all the pain and heartache.
Ugh. So did you ever drive the SV8, or did it not sort of reach that point?
No, I didn't. I don't. I'm guessing someone like Cropley would have done. Because, I mean, cars were out there, so they would have done drives. It's too long ago. I can't remember why I didn't drive it, but I didn't. I would like to have done. I suspect it was kind of okay. These cars tend to be. But, you know, it's not good enough, is it? Being kind of okay. It's not good enough being really quite good. Because these things, I think that cost like 40 grand. Which 25 years ago, whatever, you know, that would have been 9/11 money, wouldn't it? So let's imagine you built one which was as good as a 9/11, which you're not going to do. Yeah? But you do it somehow, miraculously. You built a car that's as good as a 9/11. That's not good enough, isn't it? Because, okay, it's as good as a 9/11, but why would people not just buy a 9/11? You'll get a few people. You'll get the iconoclasts and the people who want to do stuff different, who buy it because it's not a 911, because that's what everybody else has. But they're really very, very small. And so you've got to be so much better than a 911 that people will actually think, this thing is giving me something that a 911 doesn't. It's not going to happen, is it?
It's not. So, Jensen, yeah, I mean, it, 7 years ago, 2015, Autocar reported that the Jensen name was officially being revived and two models were expected by 2016. So, we were apparently
going to see... It's such a familiar story, isn't it?
It's endless. It's just on repeat, isn't it? Like a broken record.
But does it not speak something of the sort of the human spirit that despite, you know, all that precedent, you don't have to look very hard to find it. You know, Wikipedia will do. 422 car manufacturers. And to know that the odds are so overwhelmingly stacked against you. It's like that story that, again, this is going to turn into the David Tuig podcast. David wrote a story for us about climbing about the people who pioneered climbing the north face of the Eiger in the 1930s. And the people who eventually succeeded it, doing it, did it despite, they set out despite knowing that 75% of people who tried it before had died. Yeah?
Yeah.
And they thought, someone's going to get up there. Why would you bother? And it's like starting a car company. You know, you set out knowing that the overwhelming likelihood is that you'll lose all your money and your dream isn't going to come true. It'll turn into a nightmare. And yet, I find it weird. I find it curious. I just find it inspiring that despite all this, these lunatics go and do it anyway. Thank goodness for them because, you know, it gives us great stories. And just occasionally, it gives us an aerial as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Just sometimes
occasionally.
A real star. Yeah. Okay, let's have another one. Invicta. And I like Invicta because it's got a brilliant name. It's a shame it's not around these days. So it was originally founded in 1925. So again, almost 100 years ago in Cobham, Surrey. And it bounced about a bit. It was in Chelsea. It was in Virginia Water in Surrey again a bit later on. And at times, in the 20s and 30s, building some gorgeous cars, the 4.5 litre S type of 1931.
Oh, honestly, go and look. If you don't know what we're talking about, go and look at a low chassis 4.5 litre Invicta. I mean, wow. I mean, that to me is, if I was a kid in the 1930s, that would be my dream car. That would be my Lamborghini Countach. That would be the thing that was on my bedroom wall. It was so low. It was so raffish and cool. Mega. And they were really, really good cars. I know someone who races one to this day, and he always drives it to the circuit and then he races it and he drives it home again. It's just a proper thing. And then, somebody tried to do another many, many years later.
And they did, yeah. So Invictus has just come and gone over the years and it's been wound up by the courts more than once, I think. Subsumed ultimately into Fraser Nash. But in the early 2000s, it was resurrected with the Invicta S1. I didn't realise it was in Chippenham, so not far from us. Do you remember much about the S1? It was shown at the 2002 British Motor Show.
I went and drove it. I did drive. And I think I know what went wrong with that. In fact, it really was one of the better efforts. It looked really cool. It was actually very well built. And I went and drove it and I thought it was pretty credible. And I thought it had a good name. It looked quite good, a bit of the usual parts bin stuff going on. I think the specific problem with Invicta, and I can remember thinking this at the time, one of the things you have to understand, if you're going to do this and you look at companies like who do this so well, like Caterham, like Ariel, the key, in my view, is don't make anything. You know, you're not a manufacturer. Caterham don't make anything. Ariel don't make anything. They get other people who know what they're doing to make stuff, and then they assemble them. They're assembly facilities. They put cars together. And Invicta, it was a carbon fibre car. And I went into this little facility they had on some industrial tape, and they had like an autoclave in the back of it. They were doing everything themselves.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, They weren't just building the car, they were curing their own carbon. Like, I was thinking, I mean, this is just nuts. Oh, yeah, and I think the reason for it was that, if we do it ourselves, we can control the process. And then, we don't have to pay their margins and everything else. But the upfront costs of doing that, when cash flow is king with a new business. And then, very unfortunately, they did a demo. I think it might have been like in one of the sort of, run-ups to, those demos they did before the British Grand Prix. It was at Silverstone, it was very public. And someone, I don't even think it was somebody from Invicta, it was somebody they just allowed to drive the car, binned it in a big way. It was a very expensive and sadly very public binning. And I think it had nothing to do with it. I don't think anything broke on the car or anything else. I think the bloke just binned it. And we never heard of it again. It's so sad. Because I really like that guy. The bloke, I can't remember his name. Was he Bristow?
Bristow.
But Michael Bristow, there you go. He was a really nice guy. I can remember meeting him and instinctively liking him, warming towards him, and really, really, really wanting him to succeed. I didn't think he would. It would have been great, because it would have been a great name, and he was in it for the right reasons, but sadly not to be.
It had the rear lights from a VW Passat. I just remember it spotting those the moment I first saw the car.
Yeah.
Turned through 90 degrees. They actually looked pretty good, but I mean, at least they got that bit right, using parts that were already out there, already designed, manufactured, homologated. Yeah. It's just too expensive, isn't it, to tool up for your own lights. And sadly, Invicta did not survive. It was wound up in 2012 by the court again. There we go. Gone for good, maybe. Let's have another. You've already mentioned AC cars. Originally, Auto Carriers Limited. I had no idea. And this is one of the oldest independent car makers in Britain, founded in 1901.
Yeah.
That's right in at the ground floor, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
The Weller brothers of West Norwood, London. But like many of these others, it's come and gone so many times over the decades. However, what a time they had in the 60s.
Well, yeah, in the 50s and 60s. The Ace, the Greyhound, and then obviously, although it wasn't really their car, everybody thinks about AC, they think Cobra, don't they? That was really Shelby's car. As you said, yes, this amazing marriage between this beautiful British sports car and this brutal American VAs, and it did amazing things. That came back too. What are they called? Was it the Ace?
I'd
say recently, in the 90s. I drove something. It was powered by a Ford Yamaha Show V8, and it was. Brian Anglis owned the name at the time, and I don't know who owns the car. I mean, obviously, but people are still. I mean, I'm sure Carroll Shelby also. He's long gone, but his organisation, they obviously own the rights to Shelby and the Shelby Cobra and that sort of thing, and someone will own the rights to AC. So, I certainly wouldn't. I'm not quite sure what AC's current status is. You may know, but I certainly wouldn't rule out somebody else popping up with it. But they also produced one of these cars. And that looked good, and that drove well. But again, it just came down to this old problem. As looking good and being well configured and fundamentally sound in terms of its engineering, it's just not nearly enough.
This is well timed, actually, because recently Mel Nichols wrote a piece for us about the worst car he's ever driven.
Oh yeah,
it went up on a TI app recently, and it was an AC. There was a car, the AC 3000 ME, that arrived in the very late 70s into the 80s. And Mel says,
I nearly bought one.
What stopped you?
Providence, I think. No, I'll tell you exactly what stopped me. So when I was, before I was a motoring journalist, and I was briefly in the city, and I briefly had some money, and I was young and particularly stupid, I decided that I needed a mid-engine British supercar. I can't even believe I ended up with a Lotus Esprit, which, as I think I've said on this podcast before, never completed a single journey without going wrong. But it was a toss-up between that and the AC 3000 ME, and the reason actually, the reason I didn't buy the AC was the bloke who had it wouldn't let me drive it. Can't imagine why. I turned up on my Mini Metro. But no, but I suspect he also probably realised that if I drove it, I'd realise what a complete crock of shit it was and not buy it. So, but I did go and look at one, and I was quite serious about it. And if he'd let me drive it, I probably wouldn't have bought it because I would have realised how awful it was. I probably would never have actually had one. But yeah, I came quite close.
I was going to say you dodged a bullet, but I'm not sure you did because you ended up in that Esprit that apparently was all sorts of bother. But yeah, but Mel's pretty damning of that car in the article. Says it has fundamentally, he says it has fundamental handling flaws. Enormous liftoff oversteer, ultimately not enough rubber on the rear axle on the road, and all sorts of other issues as well. But yeah, I mean, AC has come back in one way or another in the last couple of years, building electric versions of older cars, the open top sports cars. There is the AC Ace RS Electric, and apparently they're doing a Cobra, again as an all electric thing. It's, if you Google, if you search around, there have been articles and so on written about it. They've got a website up, but you'd think, wouldn't you, if they were having a great time of it, they'd be much more visible. We'd have had a go for one thing. So it's hard to figure out exactly what's going on with AC at the moment. If anyone's listening from AC and you have got something fun for us to drive, let us know. Do you want to choose one to talk about? Maybe Lagonda?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I'd like to talk about Lagonda a little bit. Because as we know, it did almost come back. And it almost, I mean, obviously, everybody knows that the Lagonda brand is owned by Aston Martin. And under the previous administration, under Andy Palmer's leadership, as part of his unbelievably ambitious plan for the future of the company, Lagonda was going to be relaunched as a pure EV luxury brand. And this was a time before Rolls-Royce were even talking about doing an EV, and before Bentley was talking about an EV. And there was this big, big gap in the market. And the idea was that, obviously for a luxury car, electricity is wonderful because what do luxury cars need? They need silence and they need torque, and an EV provides that. So it's inherently well suited to. And, you know, also it doesn't matter if it's heavy. So you can put an enormous battery in it, so you can actually go places in it. And even if ultimately the range isn't that enormous, it doesn't really matter because whoever is going to spend one of these will have an S-Class or something like that in which they can go and do. So these are still not quite recreational, but these are luxury products. They're not machine, they're not working tools. And it all seemed to me, I just genuinely thought it was a really, really good idea. And the idea was, I'm not even sure I should be talking about this now, but I can't see it does any harm. The idea was that the company, Lagonda, would be launched almost as a separate company, although still under the Aston umbrella, but it would be headquartered in California. And, you know, Lagonda has, you know, great American connections. It was actually founded by an American called Wilbur Gunn, and it's named after Lagonda Creek, which is in, I don't know, Ohio? Somewhere in America. And so that was all very sort of synergistic and everything else. But then, as we know, Aston Martin got itself into all sorts of financial strife. The plan was far too ambitious. And when the new administration led by Tobias Merz came in, Lagonda was one of the very first things to get kicked into the long grass. And the sadness is now that I think they missed the boat. Because, you know, the press is full of the Rolls-Royce spectre, isn't it? And, you know, Rolls-Royce are... they now have their car. It'd be interesting, wouldn't it? I wonder whether they actually pressed the green light for that car earlier than otherwise they would have done because they thought Lagonda were coming for them. And certainly at the time when, you know, Lagonda did that electric SUV concept a few years ago and showed it and made all sorts of, frankly, not code-to-coded references to Rolls-Royce in their press materials and basically took the mick out of Rolls-Royce for being, you know, stuffy and traditional, and Lagonda was the forward-thinking blah. And I wonder whether Rolls-Royce didn't just think, oh, all right, okay, well, we'll respond to this and we'll get going with this a bit short of that. I don't know. But now that Rolls-Royce is going to be doing an all-electric luxury car. I think Lagonda's moment may well have passed. And it's such a shame because, you know, the Lagondas of the 1930s, things like the M45R, the V12 Lagondas, the W.O. Bentley designed engine, these were magnificent cars. Absolutely wonderful, wonderful things. One of them won Le Mans in 1935, which is not something that I think most people recall. Just occasionally you'll see a pre-war Lagonda bimbling down the road, and pre-war Bentley is, I think everybody knew what they look like, and they have lots of presence and purpose and everything else. But you see a Lagonda, and you just think that's beautiful, just beautiful. The kind of quintessential 1930s family British open sports car, and I'd love to see them come back. I suspect it's probably on Lawrence Stroll and Tobias's priority list, probably number 47. So far down as to, you know, not have any realistic prospect anytime soon. But I hope not.
It was a great idea, and it seemed to make sense. Making it an EV brand in particular, I guess it was too much for Aston Martin to take on at that time. Troubled IPO, just a lot going on. They need to steady the ship, didn't they? And perhaps this would have destabilised it. Okay, right. We can't have this conversation about troubled British marks without mentioning the one from Blackpool, TVR.
Oh dear.
I don't even know where we stand with TVR at the moment. I mean, it seemed troubled anyway, and then COVID hit, and that was a wrecking ball through the whole industry, wasn't it? So imagine trying to get an independent sports car maker off the ground against that backdrop. Do we know where? So it's at the Goodwood revival, wasn't it, in 2017?
17.
So coming five years ago.
This year.
Showed the Griffith.
So far as I'm aware, and I think so far as anybody else is aware, in those 5 years, they've built a car. One car. There has been some noise. I know that they got planning permission to build their factory. And if I'm honest with you, I don't know what the current status is. It may be that they'll roll out the cars this summer. Everybody judges themselves on what they feel capable of. Everybody else judges them on what they've already achieved. And what they've already achieved is one car in the last 5 years. And, you know, they say, or they certainly have said, that their depositors are very loyal, and I hope that they are, but they must be getting bored. They must be getting tired, just thinking, where are our cars? There's still a bit of me which would like it to happen, because I think TVR is, you know, I think the world's just a better place for TVRs, isn't it? Although I've never particularly rated the TVRs that I've driven, well, most of them anyway, I've always enjoyed them. They've always had a sense of occasion. And, yeah, and this one, you know, let's not forget, designed by Gordon Murray, I think it had real potential. But it's already a five-year-old car.
Yeah, and it will need...
And it hasn't hit the road yet.
It will need updating, you know,
and
reveal.
And the other problem is that the further and further away from that you get, and the closer and closer you get to, you know, when you aren't even allowed to sell a petrol-powered car in this country anymore, then, you know, your future product plan just gets completely, you know, if they got it on sale in 2018, which is what I imagine would have happened, then, you know, that would have been their plan. Yeah, that would have been fine. You know, they would have had years and years and years. But now, even if they get it on sale, I can't see it myself, and I hope I'm wrong. I'd love it to happen. I'd love it to be really good, and I'd love it to be successful. But there must now be so many people just sitting there thinking exactly what you are thinking, which is really, is it ever going to happen? What's changed now? But, you know, let's hope we're wrong.
So it had the right name, Griffith, a good name for a TVR. You can make your own mind up about the way the car looks. I don't think I'm entirely convinced. But it had promise.
No,
it had that Ford V8 used by the Mustang, tuned by Cosworth. So it probably would have been a pretty tasty motor. Manual gearbox. I think it had,
light.
Has potential. Say again? Light. Yeah, light car.
Yeah. And Gordon, you know, designed by Gordon and his team. So, you know, you'd have to bet that it would get down the road, okay?
So the factory is in Ebbw Vale, isn't it? South Wales, very near to where we spend a fair amount of our time. And actually, if you look at satellite images, Google Earth, and there are photos online, you can see how the building of the factory has progressed. And there are images of the facade. It looks quite flashy. It just remains to be seen whether or not they'll produce TVRs in it. They were looking to raise £25 million recently, weren't they? We're just going to have to sit back and wait and see, aren't we? Hopefully they'll get it all together and they'll build some great sports cars. But until that day arrives, I think it's very easy to be cynical. Do you want to pick out another one? The list is so long, we're never going to get through all of them. But do you want to pick out one more? No.
Austin Healey.
Let's have it.
Austin Healey's. They were fantastic. Particularly the 1950s ones. They got a bit sort of fat and heavy in the 60s. But, you know, 104 or 100M, these were superb, high-quality, fast British sports cars. Beautiful, very well-engineered. I mean, not sort of state-of-the-art technologically, but that was actually a good thing because it just meant that they were robust, they were rugged. I drove one recently, which was a sort of like a slightly tuned, but still fairly standard road car. It was I think it was 104. And I just really, really liked it. It was just, and I was on the road with some much faster, more exotic machinery of that kind of era. And I didn't feel shortchanged. They didn't disappear off into the distance. I don't think that they were having a lot more fun than me, despite the fact that their cars were worth many times what I was driving. And I really do hanker after one. You know, I got out of it thinking I could do, because it's not so valuable that you're going to worry about using it all the time. The bits are cheap and plentiful. They're really quite simple. So, you know, it's not going to be like, you know, so many cars where, you know, if you ding a panel, you've completely stuffed it because, you know, you'll never find another one. Or, you know, a bit of the engine breaks. Oh, well, that's it. You're going to, you know, that's going to bleed you. It's not like, I mean, they're just simple, robust, honest, straightforward, but really, really good British sports cars. And yeah, I'd love to see that back. I suspect that BMW have the name because they bought all those names when they got Rover. And I suspect that's where it lies now. And I can't see BMW doing an Austin Healey. And obviously the problem is the further away you get from when these cars did have a cachet and were highly regarded, the more distant they become and the less people care about them. I mean, people like me do because we're mad, but you know, it's not enough. It's like, you know, when Mercedes exhumed Maybach, because this was a great old name, but what they forgot was it was a great old name from the 1930s and everybody had forgotten about it. Which is why when they produced the Maybach originally, or the revived one, one reason is that it just completely struggled because nobody knew what a Maybach was. Nobody cared what a Maybach was. And maybe Austin Healey wouldn't do that well if they brought that back because of that. I don't know, but I'd love it. Can I do another?
Of course you can. I don't think I can stop you.
Okay, Alvis. Yeah. I won't dwell long on Alvis, but I think, you know, but in the 1920s and 1930s, and Alvis, I was just trying to think of a kind of like a comparison. It was like, I suppose, an F-type to a DB9. So if a Bentley was like a DB9, so if a Bentley was like the, you know, the creme de la creme of the sort of British grand tourers, then an Alvis was a very honest, very high quality, not quite as fast, not quite as expensive, but still terrific example of that art. I used to own a 1929 Silver Eagle. And they were just beautifully engineered. And yeah, I mean, they survived the war, came back, but I think they must have wound up in the 1960s or something, but they never recaptured their Ford. But in the 1920s and 1930s, Alvis was a really, really proper brand in the same way that, you know, that Lagonda was. And yeah, I'd like to see them come back. Reliant. See, when you say Reliant, everybody thinks Robin, everybody thinks Del Boy's van. You forget the Scimitar.
Yeah.
Princess Anne used to drive a Reliant Scimitar. My my best mate at my little school, Dad used to drive a Scimitar, and because my folks lived abroad, on weekends I'd go back to his place, and Dad would always come pick us up in the Scimitar, and I just love that thing. I mean, Reliant's never going to come back. And the second Scimitar, which I was a motoring journalist when that turned up, the SS1, the Michelotto designed thing, which was just so ugly. It was actually reasonable to drive, but yeah. Triumph, you know, obviously, you know, it's a highly regarded motorcycle manufacturer these days. If you think of Triumph, the cars, you think of dreadful things like, you know, Spitfires and, you know, and that sort of thing. But actually, the early TRs, TR2, TR3, TR3A, TR4, TR5, they were really, really good cars. And I miss them. Riley. Again, you know, people
God, think, Riley, so what's many.
That? I mean, you know. But in the 1930s, oh my goodness, a 1930s Riley Imp or a Riley MPH. I mean, they were Aston Martins. They were unbelievable things. And today, incredibly valued, really, really highly regarded by people who know about this stuff. Chances of Riley coming back, is there a number that's less than zero? but, you know, it's a shame. What else have we got down here?
What strikes me is that we're very often talking about quite beautiful two-seat sports cars, maybe open top. Really evocative stuff a lot of the time, isn't it?
I'm going to do one more. Sorry, you've got me on a roll now. Only because I was in the car when the company went bust.
You weren't
Marcos.
You weren't culpable, were you?
No, I wasn't. No. Marcos. Marcos went bust, and that was such a shame because they produced a great car. What was it called? The TSO or something. And we were doing a twin test with this and a Morgan Plus 8 up north, and the Marcos was so much better than the Morgan.
Really?
It really, really was. Really powerful, great looking, but actually, unlike the Morgan, had a proper chassis on it. Great driver's car. And I got a call from the office saying, whatever you do, don't answer your telephone from now on. And I go, why? They said, well, Marcos has just gone bust and the receiver wants the car because it was a, you know, it was a sizable asset of what remained of the company at that time. And we had a twin test to shoot. You know, we had pages in the magazine waiting for it. Yeah. And so, yes, I'm afraid I dodged the receiver. We got on and finished the job. And then I was in this bizarre situation of having to write a twin test between two cars, one of which you wouldn't be able to buy. And so I had to sort of say, well, had you been able to buy this Marcos, that's the car that you should have bought. But as it happens, it's gone. Panther.
Oh my goodness, Panther. They keep coming. Yeah.
Yeah. So the things like the Calista and the Lima, which were kind of like Morgans. They were sort of retro-looking sports cars. They were pretty terrible, to be honest. The one I want to talk about is the Solo, which came about, must be about 1990, something like that. Because the Panther Solo had enormous potential. Mid-engine, four-wheel drive, two-seat sports car. And it was one of the finest handling cars, certainly up until that time, probably since that I'd ever driven. It was absolutely incredible. It was light, it had narrow little tires on it. You could balance it so beautifully for a mid-engine car. It was so easy to drive. And, you know, had they been able to build it properly, had they been able to sort out a terrible noise coming from that, it had a Sierra Cosworth engine in it. You know, maybe something would have come out of it, but it looked really odd. But it was, I remember it just because it was amazing to drive. And that did make it different. There was actually a reason to buy that over anything else because it was so outstanding to drive. But sadly, there were many more reasons why you shouldn't buy it. And nobody did. I think, I don't know what they made, you know, a couple of dozen of those. I don't know. And that was, that was the end of Panther.
Just imagine how varied the British sports car scene would be now if only half of these companies had survived and been able to produce sports cars. It's extraordinary. Yeah. I know you want to mention briefly DeLorean.
Well, not really. I just thought we ought to.
Okay, well, we know there was a teaser image recently, wasn't there, of a shadowy car with the gullwing doors in the raised position.
Yeah.
We know it's coming back as an EV of some sort, don't we?
Okay, can I tell you what's clever about it?
Go on.
I'll tell you what's clever about it is that all these cars that come back, they come back because they got some wonderful heritage. And then what happens is when they come back, they fail to live up to that wonderful heritage. This car's not going to have that problem.
No.
No one's going to go, oh, it's good, but it's not as good as an original DeLorean, because it can still be really terrible and be better than an original DeLorean. So that burden of expectation doesn't sit on its shoulders. And I also think that, and this says nothing about DeLorean at all and everything about Robert Zemeckis, who's the bloke who directed the three Back to the Future films. DeLorean had a brand created for it by Hollywood, didn't it? And so there is, bizarrely, warmth out there towards DeLorean, despite the fact the cars, the very few cars that did were produced in really pretty reprehensible circumstances, they were just terrible. Our chum Chris Harris drove one on Top Gear, didn't he? And was fairly forthright about it, and rightly so. That's going to come back, we think.
Yeah. Yeah, there'd be no positive sentiment attached to the DeLorean at all if it wasn't for the movie franchise, would
none,
it?
Actually, none whatever. People would just remember the financial impropriety, all those poor people in Belfast who lost their jobs. It would, a grubby, grubby story. And there are so many others, we have, Austin, Wolseley, Morris, Standard, Lee Francis, HRG. I could go forever. I'm probably disappearing down small niches here. But you're right. It is amazing how many there have been. And also, the thing is, they weren't all rubbish. Some of them were really, really good. Lagonda were really good. Austin Healey was really good. And they still didn't survive.
We haven't mentioned MG. We haven't mentioned Bristol. The list just seems to go on and on and on.
MG exists, doesn't it? If you can call an SUV like that. But MG, let's not forget, very successful on the Mille Miglia, set land speed records. They were the sort of quintessential affordable British sports car, both before and after the war. MG Motor will try and do something. Usually what happens is you get a sports car brand like Porsche, which decides to make an SUV. Now MG makes SUVs, and I'm kind of hoping they're going to do a sports car to provide themselves with some brand credibility, but I suspect not.
Well,
anyway, I'm rambling.
Let's hope so. Okay, we better wrap that one up somewhere. So let's do that here. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to JBR Capital for sponsoring the podcast, as ever.
Yep.
All the contact info you need is in the description. Please rate and review the podcast. That's really important. And please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to or watch this podcast. But we've got a listener question now. I've not briefed you on this one. This is from Graham King. But you'll be fine. This is from Graham King. Do you have any experience of driving vehicles other than cars? I worked for years as a bus and coach driver. Terrible job, but the driving was great fun. So while you ponder that one, vehicles other than cars, I'll give my answer. I just want to talk about those curious vehicles with handlebars like a motorbike and that you straddle like a motorbike, but which you don't lean into the corner on. So I'm talking about quad bikes. I'm talking about snowmobiles. Because like cars, you turn into a corner and naturally they roll outwards because, well, they either have four wheels or they have wider tracks and skis. I find it totally counterintuitive that you roll out and you're still supposed to turn the handlebars that way. So it's that motion of turning the handlebars and rolling in the sort of opposite direction that I just, somehow my brain can't commute. And it just means that I never feel in control of these things. They're fun, but when you're going quickly, and particularly through, say, down a narrow track through the trees, I feel like I'm moments away from having an enormous shunt.
Yeah, and you don't tend to get small shunts on those, do you?
No.
Because they tend to end up on top of you.
Ouch.
Oof. Yes. Okay, two. One, I drive really quite a lot. We have a little bit of land here which needs managing, and so I have a tractor. I love my tractor. It's the only tractor in the world with a Nürburgring sticker on the side of it. And what I love about it, it's an early 80s, not very big Kubota. So it's got no tech on it at all, which means it needs managing all the time. And you're always busy. You're always doing something, particularly if you're, if you're topping a field. So you're driving something that's hanging off the back of the tractor as well. And I don't know I'm sure most people listening to this have seen Clarkson's Farm or clips of it. But on a scale of about 100 of that, it's kind of like that. But I mean, I love cars that keep you busy, and my tractor keeps me busy all the, because you're always having to think. So that's one. And the second one is, I was on some Mercedes launch a few years ago. I don't know, I must have been in Germany or Austria or somewhere. Anyway, we were on some big test facility, and there was a bit of downtime, as you often get in these things. And one of the activities that was available to journalists with nothing better to do is you could go and drive an Actros. Now, do you know what an Actros is?
No.
An Actros is their biggest lorry.
Yeah.
It's their biggest lorry. It's the absolute transcontinental, you know, if you think of an enormous lorry with a Mercedes badge in it, you're thinking of an Actros. And it didn't have a rig on the back, so it was just the lorry bit. And we had this huge expanse of tarmac, so you really couldn't go wrong. And I can remember so many things about it. I can remember just, you know, the climb up into it. You know, it was so far off the ground. You're climbing and climbing, and then you end up, and then you get into this cabin, and it's so luxurious, and it's got all the widgets. And then you get in it and you drive it, and it has no traction at all. One of those things without a thing on the back. I think it might have been slightly damp. And it had traction control. And unless you drove it very carefully, the thing basically, it was just with traction control lights flashing at you. But I can just remember how incredibly civilized it was up there. And, you know, how Mercedes had thought hard about the life of the person, you know, who'd be driving it, who'd be spending basically their entire working life. This was their office. It happened to go from one place to another. It's not like you and I, who might go and occasionally do a longish drive. That's what they do all the time, you know, for as long as their tachometer will allow them to do it. And that was fascinating. And it sort of made me want to experience them a bit more. But, you know, how you do that without going down the road to getting an HGV license, which I'd never use, I don't know. But I'm fascinated by all different sorts of transport, particularly if it brings a new experience. And that certainly did. So there you go. Thank you, Graham.
It's interesting hearing you talk about a tractor. I didn't know you had one, but it reminds me of a conversation I had.
Come over. You can have a go.
Well, there we go. That has to happen. That will happen.
Excellent.
I had a conversation with the great late Pat Flynn, who was right at the heart of the British rally community, a brilliant guy. And he was explaining his theory to me as to why so many very quick rally drivers come from farming communities. And I guess there are practical reasons. Farmers have space to store rally cars. They have space to drive rally cars. But his big point was that if you're a young guy driving a tractor and you're at the far end of the farm in a muddy field, you don't want to get stuck. You do not want to get stuck and have to trudge all the way back and come and get help. So you're going to learn throttle control. You're going to learn skill in rally driving. And it was very, very interesting to hear him, you know, explain that theory to me.
My tractor, it's got, this is such a cool thing. So I get it stuck quite a lot, okay?
Right.
And so you're sitting there, and one wheel's not doing anything, the other wheel's going, and it's stuck. But behind your right heel, there is a bar. And if you kick the bar, the axle locks solid.
Oh, nice.
And you just come out like a cork out of a bottle. and then you're off again.
That's brilliant.
And it's got asymmetric braking. So you can break each wheel. You can break them together, or you can undo the link.
Yeah.
And when I'm in the fields and you're trying to do really tight turns, you use the asymmetric braking to turn the tractor as much as you use the steering wheel. And that's a great experience to have, and a tire art that you need to master as well. And it's good fun. Tractors rock.
There you go. Well, Graham King, thank you for getting your question in. ask a good question like that and we'll answer it. Yeah, do get them in. Thank you all for listening, and we'll be back to talk to you all again same time next week.
Bye.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.